Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. My name is Mike Pratz, and today we reach the end of our mini-series in critical care ultrasound articles. This is part 3 of 3. For those of you who weren't able to listen to the previous two episodes, I'll fill you in. This podcast was recorded in Dublin last year at a conference, and it is a collection of minds, people that are experts in point-of-care ultrasound and world-renowned educators, coming together and just discussing some concepts and some recent papers. So listen in, you'll learn a lot, and I hope you enjoy it.
So Andy, I'm a simple man.
I've always said so. There's no disagreements, no one is shaking.
I don't see any shaking heads. It doesn't come across. And I picked a neat paper that one of my colleagues in Melbourne brought to my attention. So it's called Cardiac Limited Ultrasound Examination Techniques to Augment the Bedside Cardiac Physical Examination. So it's quite a mouthful, but in my mind, the words that stick are CLUE.
Yeah, that was the acronym. So this is another four-letter ultrasound acronym, the exactly. CLUE examination.
And they are in abundance. And it was written by, their lead author is a guy called Bruce Kimura, and he practices in San Diego, and he's a cardiologist, but he seems to be very interested in point of care ultrasound as well, which made it kind of attractive to me to talk about as a paper. They look for 4 windows and 6 ultrasound signs. It's like a lot of the other four-letter ultrasound acronym protocols that we use, like RUSH, and gives the novice user a quick way of looking at somebody's heart and lungs and IVC to say whether this patient might need more extensive imaging or are their systems grossly normal. And it is very, we've talked a lot about right heart strain, and this is very basic. We look at 4 lung windows. We start off at a parasternal lung axis.
Yeah, looking at the heart, yeah.
Yeah, parasternal lung axis, and look for cardiac dysfunction. So that's the C in CLUES. And the sign that they use in that is our septal separation. And they use a cutoff of 1 centimeter. Then working backwards, they go and have a look at left atrial enlargement. So that's defined as whether your aortic root by visual inspection is larger than the left atrium on your parasternal lung axis.
So the only one cardiac view in this examination is the parasternal lung. That's the only
There's another one later on down the line. So there's parasternal lung axis, the first one. Then they move on to 2 lung views. So an apical lung view, your patient can be sitting up or supine, and they look for ultrasound lung comets. Now, that's the U in CLUES, but as we all know, what they're actually looking for is a pathological amount of B-lines, and that's to determine whether your patient may or may not have increased tissue density or fluid in their interlobular septum. They move on to another lung window, so they move around to the posterolateral aspect of the chest and have a look for a pleural effusion. If you see a pleural effusion, then you've identified some pathology there. And then we move back to their final subcostal window, so a cardiac window, subcostal 4-chamber, and look for subcostal right ventricular enlargement. The way they define that is the size of the right ventricle, does it approach the size of the left ventricle? Because we know that on an apical 4-chamber, that it should be approximately 2/3 of the size of the left ventricle. But they look for, does it approach the size of the left ventricle, the right ventricle, on the subcostal 4-chamber view. Finish up with the 6th sign is a subcostal IVC view, and look at the respiratory variation of the IVC and the caliber of the IVC. So the author has put together this protocol, I suppose, and has used that for the last 10 years with his internal medicine residency program, and described how he was able to get all his residents to be able to perform this exam, and he describes some of the pathology that he's identified. I think it's something that we're doing anyway in some format or some form or another.
It's interesting if you hear him speak ever. He, which I've stolen many times, describes the LA enlargement as the HbA1c of the heart. Yeah. So I really like that. And, you know, no real other acronym looks at the LA like that.
I was going to say, because that's not something that I focus on.
The interesting thing about this one is it, like, the one of the first purposes of point of care echo from our standpoint in the ED is effusion and tamponade. And that's not specifically kind of addressed in the clue paper. So like, I mean, I personally like Rush, but you're right. We're essentially doing all the same thing with a whole bunch of different acronyms assigned to it.
I'd like to agree with you, Rachel. I worry about patients I put under anesthesia who have a large left atrium. And I worry that there is a higher risk that they may go into fast AFib, for example. So I tend to try and sneak in a bit of magnesium during the case. And in general, the SHOs and registrars...
Anesthesia is amazing.
Yeah, there I am, waiting until secret the blood pressure is high enough to sneak in a little bit of magnesium because I know they have that large atrium and I don't want them to go into perioperative AFib. But the thing I would say, I'm not sure we need another acronym. For me, it's all been about have a look at the lungs, have a look at the heart, have a look at the IVC. Integrate it with your history and physical exam. But I really do like the focus on the left atrium.
So sorry, are we missing a beat here? Because left atrium... I mean, I'm aware that if you've got a big left atrium, it's going to be more risk for AFib. It's going to be, why would you do your cardioversion? Because you're just going to go straight back into it. Is that all that you're looking for when you're looking at the left atrium? Is there other stuff going on there that we're missing by not looking at the left atrium? Is it all about AFib or is there other things going on?
I'd agree with you, Andy. I worry about, you know, paroxysmal AFib. You know, it's a 30% drop in your cardiac output, and that can just sometimes be enough when the patient's already sick, that they don't have the reserve to, you know, come back from the situation they're in. So sometimes, you know, they're a bit hypotensive. It might be because we've given them an anesthetic, which is a negative inotrope, or they may be a bit hypotensive because they're sick with sepsis, and then they've got this propensity to go into AFib. And then the two together, it's not a good combination.
So, and is it kind of predictive of heart? I know obviously when you measure wedge pressure, that's kind of looking in an indirect way at the end diastolic pressure in the left heart as a predictor of kind of pulmonary edema and all that carry on. Does the size of the left atrium help with that?
That I don't know. I just know when the left atrium is enlarged, it's not a good thing for the
patient.
It's
the HbA1c of the heart.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way. And I always think of Bob Jarman's teaching where he talks about 3 centimeters, 4 centimeters and 5 centimeters if you want to remember things easily. So he talks about, you know, the aortic root, you shouldn't be more than 3 centimeters. Your left atrium shouldn't be more than 4 centimeters. And in certain circumstances, the LV shouldn't be more than 5 centimeters. Obviously, you've got to look at the patient. Are they athletic? You know, that sort of thing. What size are they? But that for me has been a useful acronym as I progress.
Two other reasons that I kind of thought this paper was useful was because used a handheld GE V-scan machine to do this. So it's really point of care. The way he described it was how he integrated this simple protocolized point of care test into to augment a physical exam. So it's never meant to be a detailed look at all the components of your heart or lungs, but it's certainly just adds on to the physical exam that we already do, and it might prompt somebody to go and get a more detailed echo. You know, that was published in 2015. It'd be nice to see this study or this protocol validated if that was ever going to happen, and to see the performance characteristics of that. But
you mentioned handheld kind of ultrasounds. I know the one that I've had email contact with, Philippe Roulat in Canada, who you know, Catherine, he would commonly use a handheld machine as part of his clinical practice. Does anybody here use a handheld machine as part of their clinical practice?
So I use a V-scan. I really like the new version because there's a linear probe, and the linear probe is very useful for having a look at the pleural line. It's very useful for vascular access and very useful for blocks. So I miss it for those reasons. And in my practice so far in the last 3 years, I've found myself putting in landmark lines twice. The first time was in the maternity, no linear probe available because they only use low frequency probes for having a look at the fetus. And, you know, when you're transferring a patient on vasopressors and on sedation, not having a central line can be a bit tricky, especially if you have a half an hour journey in the ambulance. So that's why I went for the landmark, and I was grateful to have been trained in the landmark era. The second time was a KPC case, and again, are you going to put your only ultrasound in the operating room or a theatre out of commission for 24 hours?
What does KPC mean?
So carbapenemase resistant organisms. Oh. So for us, sick people, sepsis, very bad bugs, and basically you might need colistin to treat it if it's sensitive to colistin. So when you have these cases come into theatre, that theatre is out of commission for 24 hours. In general, you've got to bioquil the theatre and you've got to bioquil whatever ultrasound that you use on that patient. So we were heading into the evening. We have one ultrasound machine. This is a busy, you know, 9 theatre complex. So I know that the registrar would be left without an ultrasound machine for the evening. And I can do a landmark line now, and that ultrasound machine can be used overnight. And ironically, it was. So it is interesting. I think it's just a case of where those landmark skills are useful. And in increasingly, the cardiac anaesthesia program are reteaching them, because just dependence on machines, we're learning, you know, not a great thing.
Can I raise, I know this is kind of a dirty little question within point of care ultrasound, how do you manage the governance issues surrounding handheld devices and storage of images and quality assurance? Because obviously all of our machines have good PAX, NIMAS, whatever storage. How do you do that with the handheld? Because obviously this author was using it in his own practice, he can document things, but how would we go about dealing with that?
So the current handhelds now, like the tablet machines, they are integratable with middleware software that we frequently use, as well as they can be going to PACS or iCloud servers that serve that are compatible with PACS. How that gets done is really how hospital IT wants it to be done, but it's now possible. Okay. In the older versions, like with the older V-scans, that wasn't possible, and you literally had to USB or dock.
You might even have to print it out.
Right.
Okay, so that's interesting, but that's good to hear, because I think that's a lot of people who aren't really into POCUS. Certainly one of the biggest issues is governance, training, how you look after all this stuff, but that's good to see that it is possible within your devices.
2015, that's when it started.
Okay. Your devices. Okay, to 2 years ago, I'm behind the times.
I just wanted to point out that this was the odds ratios that they came up with in here as predictors of in-hospital mortality were pretty impressive. Even if you had a positive IVC scan, so a inferior vena cava plethora, that was correlated with inpatient death with a odds ratio of 5.8, which is pretty significant, especially when we talk about when we looked at that REASON trial. I think we were talking a little bit about that before. Odds ratio for death when you have cardiac activity or no cardiac activity in arrest, that was only 3.6. It's pretty significant numbers that these can predict how well a patient is going to do.
Okay, we'll go on to the next paper. Next paper is my paper. We're going to look really throw the cat among the pigeons by saying that point of care ultrasound is killing people. That's really what I'm going to say in this next paper. So we're looking at the use of ultrasound during cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So title here is ultrasound use during cardiopulmonary resuscitation is associated with delays in chest compressions. So the result of the paper is in the title. This was just published in Resuscitation. Mike Winters is one of the authors in that from the University of Maryland. And the main author is Maite Huis Intvelde. What do you think? Anybody else go with that? There's too many apostrophes. I don't think I can pronounce that.
They're doing it wrong.
I'm doing it wrong anyway. So this is a really, I find this a fascinating paper. So this is a really nice thing. So in their emergency department, in their recess rooms, they have continuous recording video monitoring. So 3 recess rooms with continuous video capabilities. Everything that happens in those rooms is monitored. They use that for quality assurance and training purposes and have somehow managed to get this past ethics. This happens in a number, and I've seen a number of these papers now, and they're really interesting. So every cardiac arrest that landed in one of these 3 video equipped rooms, they later went back and reviewed the videos and had a look at the length of the pulse check. And they then compared the length of the pulse check during CPR when ultrasound was used, compared with the length of the pulse check when ultrasound was not used. And that's a very, very simple clinical question that they're asking is, does the use of ultrasound increase that pulse check? Now, in the American guidelines, the pulse check is meant to be 10 seconds. In the UK ALS guidelines, it's 5 seconds. We're really strict about it down here. And so they wanted to... It was ACLS. No, I did my exam last week. I had to look it up on ACLS, and it was on the resus.org website. Yeah. It's actually 5 seconds, believe it or not. This was news to me. I know, seems hard.
You better speed up those pulse checks.
So in this study, as I say, they looked at the video, how long were these pulse checks? And the bottom line here is they found when POCUS was being used as part of the pulse check, this period between cycles of CPR, it was a 21-second pulse check. When ultrasound was not used, it was a 13-second pulse check. So in this study, they're suggesting that ultrasound is delaying the pulse checks here by doubling the length of time. And that's the main finding here. That's all I'm going to throw out. Reasonably simple, reasonably objective data. What do you think?
My argument is they're doing it wrong. you know, it's if it was designed to be within 10 seconds and they have violated that, then that's the job of the person running the code to, you know, either curtail finding of the view or to monitor how long those pulse checks are. Because there are multiple papers also showing that it's feasible to do it within 10 seconds. And so I'm not sure what the shock trauma guys are doing that they're not achieving it within 10 seconds.
I wish I had heard you say that before I threw away all my ultrasound machines after this paper.
So I think everybody in this room is going to say it's not the problem with the ultrasound, it's the problem with how the recess is run. So how do we do that? How do we improve our recess management? Because in this, obviously in this department, no matter what we say about it, there was a delay, seemed to be introduced by the ultrasound. So how would you guys avoid that?
And I don't think this is unique to this department.
No, I don't think so.
The authors of this paper did a service to everyone by pointing out that this is a really common problem that I'm sure
this is
everybody...
a risk of ultrasound use.
Exactly.
You know, all the cardiac arrest and coding literature is during the pulse check. Why are we waiting for the pulse check to throw ultrasound on? You can do real-time cardiopulmonary monitoring. You can do real-time compression guidance. You can do real-time, you can record whole codes with the ultrasound probe on the
body. You can
use
TEE.
Or you could use TEE.
So you're talking about having...
I don't have TEE.
You're talking about having the probe in the subxiphoid position during...
Or actually, not just subxiphoid position. It's literally any position you can get a good view of the LB. So whether that's parasternal, paraapical, an atypical view, it can be done.
So a lot of us don't even try. We just don't even try and get a view because there's CPR going on. But you're suggesting you actually sometimes, certainly reasonably often, get a view if you put a bit of effort in.
And it can be really helpful. I have cases where a patient comes in on a Lucas device and the Lucas is ongoing and you can see that the Lucas is not delivering adequate compressions, even though the surface anatomy of that Lucas is appropriate. That highlights to me that maybe the teaching of the way we're delivering compressions needs to be rethought.
I was going to ask if you thought it was easier to do it during CPR with a mechanical CPR device as opposed to a human that may be blocking your way or anything. Do you think there's any difference there?
Not really, because it's still going to be blocking the same area. I'm not saying this is possible in every single patient. There's definitely challenging patients where you can't get good views, but I don't find any difference. In the same way we have re-guided manual compressions, the same way we have re-guided Lucas compressions using real-time monitoring.
I'm not sure if subxiphoid is the best view either, because often the stomach is so inflated with air when they've been ventilated.
Because that's our go-to during cardiac arrest. Always subxiphoid.
It's so much air in the stomach most of the time, so I usually try to go apical, which is great with Lucas device.
It ends up being a modified apical or even a right-sided parasternal shooting this way. So there's all sorts of modifications you can do, but your whole goal is just to get the LV and see what's happening.
And have one dedicated sort of sonographer or someone who's just doing the echo. They shouldn't do anything else.
I wonder what the reason was that they stayed for longer than we would expect on the chest, or why the pulse check was that long.
They don't give us that degree of detail, presumably because it's difficult finding views. Again, they point out this is Baltimore, the BMI overall 60-70% greater than 30. Sure. So that maybe
all the U.S.
Never mind Baltimore.
The entire U.S.
This is
another reason why subxiphoid isn't good.
And
this
kind of patients.
This was a point dwelt on actually at SMAC conference recently by Haley Manamet. He was advocating the parasternal long axis or short axis view if you could get it during the pulse check. And the other thing I'd just like to add was I always thought if you're going to do ultrasound peri arrest during the pulse check that you put the probe on where you think you'll get a view and you press the save click button until the 10 seconds is up and then off you go. And you actually analyze the clips, while the CPR is ongoing. Now that's how I was taught. So I'd really be interested in what other people have to say about how they do
an excellent point.
Peri-arrest echo.
Yeah, I mean, it can be mixed. I have cases where using ultrasound guidance when we repositioned, you know, the person has an end tidal not compatible with life, and as soon as you reposition doing real time guidance, their end tidal goes to 30, and now you have signs of ROSC.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are cases that you're still repositioning and it's just gone. They're goners, and you can't, you know, reperfuse.
I guess we should still use both, but always put in an arterial line on the cardiac arrest patients.
Yeah, that's another whole different
or way all by TEEs.
Way much better. Yeah.
So definitely some good tip. Most people certainly wouldn't. Certainly everybody's go-to is a subxiphoid, and I think a collected wisdom of you guys who know what you're doing would say subxiphoid often not the best for the pulse check echo. Consider doing your parasternal or your apical. Probably your apical might be as good as any to try and get. The other thing that Catherine suggested, collecting your images but interpreting them away from the patient. Collect your 4 or 5 seconds, take the probe off, recommence CPR, look at your image afterwards.
I would just add one more to that. I know a lot of people are talking about pre-charging their defibrillators now prior to the actual pulse or rhythm check so that you can deliver a shock. In the same way, you should be kind of pre-charging your ultrasound prior to when you're actually looking. So make sure you have somebody, like Chris was saying, have somebody that's dedicated to doing the ultrasound and let them be ready and obviously aware of when that ultrasound's going to take place. So have gel on the transducer and be ready to obtain that image as soon as possible if you're not doing it continuously throughout the arrest.
Definitely, I think excellent paper, though, really highlights that, I mean, obviously we're enthusiastic about ultrasound, but there are, like any intervention you do, there are risks of benefit and risks of harm. There are definite risks of harm with ultrasound, and we have to be good enough clinicians to recognize when we're getting distracted by the silly gray little black and white lines and make sure we're doing maybe some of the more important interventions. So a really great paper and really useful, but lots and lots of potential ways to avoid this happening in your next resus.
I would just say it's really important to know this literature as it comes out, because you want to be able to know what to do with your findings in ultrasound, know how good they are and the limitations of ultrasound. Part of using it is to know how good your tool performs.
For example, we all now use ultrasound to put in central lines, and increasingly people aren't doing the small things. So they're not necessarily, putting on a bit of extra PEEP if the patient is intubated. They're not putting a shoulder roll into that under that patient that has a short neck. There's so many things that you can do in terms of achieving success, and leaving it all to the machine, I think, is a mistake. So just to reiterate the point, the simple things, we should do them well, and that ultrasound's an adjunct.
That's interesting, because when I teach ultrasound to people, I say it's either like, did you learn to drive in an automatic car, or did you learn to drive with a stick shift or manual? And if you might understand the settings on the machine, if it's all done for you on an auto focus and a preset, you don't have to think about it as much. Whereas if you have to adjust stuff and work for your images and optimize your images and know your machine and know its limitations, that's when you start to understand the modality a lot better.
And also know the anatomy. So, for example, one of the things that happens in vascular access using the ultrasound machine is that we go for where the vein looks biggest. And that's often lower down in the neck, near the apex of the lung. So for the novices, they're much more likely to cause a pneumothorax because they're going to move that little bit further with the needle because they're starting out. When we learned the landmark techniques, there were so many things that we did that kept us safe. We used a seeker needle. We were further back up the neck. We used the landmarks that we knew. Now people, when you ask them, they often don't know the landmarks. They just know that when they put the probe on, they'll see the vein. So I feel a bit passionate about this as an anaesthetist, but I'd love to see that we actually embrace those things that made us safer when we were starting off before, and we pass them on to the next generation.
I'm going to press the big red button.
Whoa. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. Well, that's a wrap for this mini-series on critical care ultrasound articles. I hope you enjoyed it. I have to thank my friend Andy Neal for putting this all together and editing it, and thanks to my other good friend Kian McDermott for helping organize this. Remember, you can check out a lot of this audio at RCEM Learning podcast as well. That's rcemlearning.co.uk. Give me some feedback if you like having this sort of thing thrown in there with the other podcasts intermittently. Feel free to check out our website at ultrasoundgel.org. You can give us a good rating on iTunes. That would help us out. And you can contact me from the website or on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+. Look forward to talking to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel, more
ultrasound gel podcast.